Next speaker is Art Rosenfeld, who is responsible for a lot of the physics output of the from the
Thank you, Stan. The title I was assigned was working on bubble chambers with Louis, but when I came to actually sit down and put some slides together. So I was the first outside PhD postdoc that Louis hired. And bubble chambers were, at that stage of the game, 4 inches in diameter, hydrogen bubble chambers, with a 10-inch planned on the way. And somehow or other, Louis decided that I ought to work on bubble chamber data processing. Now, data processing is a fine art now. We started off in assembly language with IBM punch cards, of course. And the computers at LBL, Lawrence Berkeley Lab, it's now Lawrence Berkeley National Lab, but I'm too old to learn new names. The computer was an IBM 650 with a drum memory and wasn't up to it, but Livermore was working and always prided itself on having one of every computer around. And so I used to teach class during the daytime and go do computer programs at night at Livermore. I'm going to show you some... Oh, what I started to say is Louis was not only my friend. As Rich said, he doesn't suffer foolish ideas simply, and I used to say I was one of Louis' best friends because I was on speaking terms with him on the average of 4 days a week. He was also my neighbor. My wife actually found him, discovered that a house at 131 Southampton was up for sale, and we live at 160 Southampton. And that recalls an interesting story about the day of the Nobel Prize, or the night of the Nobel Prize. Rich says he heard about it in a barber chair, I think you just said. He got his usual phone call from Sweden at 3 in the morning. And first thing he did, I guess, was to wake up Don Gao, who was the crew chief and designer of the bubble chambers, and congratulate him. And then he really couldn't figure out what to do till people started getting up. The next thing I knew, it was 5:30 in the morning. That's the time the Chronicle arrives. And Louis had gone downstairs in his house to get the Chronicle. And sure enough, the Chronicle had the news. Louis comes over to my house and rings the doorbell. And I get up very sleepily and look down from the bathroom window. And Louis couldn't figure out anything to say except, "Have you seen the Chronicle?" Anyway, that's the same. That's another version of the picture that Rich showed you. This was the team of people that the press was shown off with at the time of the Nobel Prize, starting from a 4-inch chamber here, something I don't recognize here, a 10-inch chamber, a 25-inch chamber, I think. And then you couldn't, it was working and you couldn't carry it around anyway. It with its housing weighed hundreds of tons. But this is a spare top glass from the 72-inch chamber, which was roughly the size and appearance of a sarcophagus. I want to tell this story. This is also Nobel Prize time. The man is, of course, Louis, and the woman cutting the cake is Anne McClellan. And what I remember most strongly about Anne McClellan was her idea of an intercom service. We had a suite of rooms in Building 50, which Rich has mentioned to you. And And I was within earshot. My desk was within earshot of Ann's. And Ann would answer the phone very professionally and say, Professor Alvarez's lab. And then if it was somebody that Louis wanted to talk to, she'd say, oh, I'll go find Professor Alvarez. And then she would get up and she would yell, Louis! If that didn't work, she would go out in the hall and yell really loud. I'm going to show you some pictures which I copied as photographs from this nice book by Pete Trower, which actually it's interesting. I'd be interested in knowing how many of you in the audience have seen this book or own this book? Oh, not the overwhelming majority, so that's good. This is actually an idea which Frank Solmitz, with whom I collaborated to do the data processing programs for the bubble chamber for kinematics. And some event was arriving, some birthday was arriving, and we thought it would be nice to get a collection of Alvarez's more interesting papers, sort of what Rich ran through with you now, and then have a commentary. One of them is by Stan Wojcicki, for example, talking about the importance of these papers and what happened after the paper was published and whether Louis stayed in the field or not. Unfortunately, between the time we thought about it and didn't do anything about it, Frank Solmitz died of being run into by a bicycle coming down the Radlab Hill. And I moved over into what I thought was going to be a 2 or 3 year sabbatical doing energy efficiency. And Peter came in and picked up the idea and did a very, very fine job. And the next few pictures are stolen with permission from Pete Trower. This is Louis's. The book contains a reprint of Louis's Nobel Prize lecture, in which he meticulously gives credit to his team. As Rich said, he was team spirited enough to bring us all to Stockholm. And I think it was originally published in Science. Is that right, Rich? Not sure. But anyway, this is where I got it, and you can read some. I want to talk a little bit about data processing. This is a 10-inch bubble chamber picture with a beam of K minus, pi minus. In fact, it says so. With a beam of pi minus mesons doing what's then known as associated production of a K0, which decays into 2 pi's, and the hadron changes and became a lambda, which in turn decays into a proton. After having gone a long, long distance, decays into a proton and a pi minus. The data processing system involved 3 stages, which were called PANG for momentum and angle, and KIC, which I was responsible for, and I can't remember what the hell it stands for. And it's got the words kinematics in it, but I don't know what the ICK stands for anymore. Oh, yes, C must be constraints. Constrained kinematics is probably getting there. Thank you. But I do want to say a little bit about how the system worked. The I'll tell you how it worked best. Incidentally, best means at that time we relied on professional scanners, typically students, one of whom was Janet, can't remember her last name, who became Janet Alvarez. Right. And the event designation, however, the fitting, was then done by physicists. And for example, here, each track which is fed into the program is fed in with an error calculated by Pang, momentum and angle. And then you make a hypothesis. So each vertex has to certify, has to comply with four constraints: conservation of momentum, conservation of energy, which in this case means if you're creating particles, conservation of mass and kinetic energy. So this event would have the hypothesis of being just what it says on the slide, pi minus p goes to k0 plus lambda. In the case of the hypothesized k0 decaying into two pi's, the direction of the k0 is very well known from where the pi minus disappears to where the two pi's reappear, but the momentum is completely unknown. And so you have a bunch of vertices, all of which have to be coupled together with the right number of constraints. And then you put in the range energy relation for those particles which are going to stop. And you keep on making hypotheses until one of them fits. And this sounds pretty easy. And the only problem was that we finally got the rate up to 800,000 pictures a year, at which stage we decided the bubble chamber was nearing the end of its useful life and we didn't develop it anymore. And each picture could have yielded several interesting events. So that was fun. The final product that Kick went into was a histogram-making routine. So as Stan Wojcicki knows very well, you could look for bumps in mass of charged particles or missing mass of neutral particles and discover lots of resonances. And that was very satisfying. And the whole thing together, starting from the bubble chamber development and the engineers through the data processing, was a lot of fun. I got involved in the one place where Louis thought it was dumb, in then trying to work with phenomenologists to make tables for the particle data group. The particle data group was started in 1957. In 2007, it celebrated its 50th birthday. It's still going strong. It used to be a pocket-sized diary called wallet cards. Well, it started off as wallet cards. And then in Russian, the name for a card is the same as the name for a sheet. So the Russians used to call them, they grew. And then finally they became a data booklet, and now they're, of course, online. And Louis thought that was a big waste of my time. He never did have any enthusiasm for the particle data group. That's the bubble chamber itself, the 72-inch chamber. You can barely see the chamber for the complications. But here's this sarcophagus up here. And the damn thing walked to position itself at the right angles and so on for a beam. So it had six legs, any three of which were on the ground as it walked, and the other three were up in the air. And the whole thing was so heavy they had to rip up the floor, the experimental floor, and put in extra concrete and rebars to hold it. This is an early story. In fact, I wrote down the date. Oh, Rich, here, both of your glasses.
I think it was 56.
This particular picture was 57. So we had hydrogen bubble chamber, you get some deuterium for free. And so in hydrogen bubble chambers, where every picture practically has a stopping mu minus meson or mu plus, and they decay, had a stopping pi plus, sorry, try again. And they decay into mu plus and a neutrino. And the mu plus has an energy of 4 MeV, which is its share of the mass, and goes 1 centimeter in the bubble chamber. So we see those all the time. What happened here, and I don't know who first picked up these events, maybe it was Bob Tripp, 10-inch chamber events, so that's why it was early in the game, in which the track of the muon, the mu minus, was not 1 centimeter, but 1.6 centimeters long. And there's something else weird about some of the events, and that is, if you look here, I don't know, you certainly can't see it from the back of the room, but the second particle coming off starts a finite distance, about a millimeter in real space, from the mu minus, which stopped. So the muon was, first of all, too long, and secondly, it drifted and then it decayed. So this brings up a whole field of physics. I'm now adding one to Rich Muller's, although this was a real discovery, but this was not expected, in which what's going on is that the mu minus forms what we used to call a molecule. I guess it's officially called a mu-mesic atom. Proton plus mu minus makes an atom, but it's 200 times smaller because of the mass ratio is 200 times larger. And that's pretty small. And so then this mu-mesic atom goes bouncing around in the liquid hydrogen until the muon decays. Well, the next picture is pi decays into a 1.6 centimeter long muon. There's no gap this time. It quickly did something and decayed again. So what's going on is that you get some deuterium for free. And I shouldn't have written this out as an equation, but I didn't. I think I can say it. What goes on is that the mu-mesic atom goes drifting around the hydrogen until it comes close to a helium. And then it prefers the helium because the reduced mass, deuterium, deuteron. Everything I said in the last 10 seconds is wrong. It prefers the deuteron. You got the deuteron for free. What is it? 1 in 5,000, I think, is the deuteron density. And it forms, it can get switched off to the deuteron. The deuteron has a reduced mass, which is, I don't know, 135 electron volts or so less than hydrogen. And so it transfers. And this provoked a whole field. My gosh, if we could just get a really long life, if we could discover a long-lived mu minus, something that lived 10 to the minus 5 seconds instead of 10 to the minus 6 seconds, then you could get hundreds of decays before the thing disappeared. So you could have cold fusion, all for a very low price. And the Russians were particularly interested in this. There's been a Russian team at CERN for years, which has been trying to figure out, can you get up to 200 events under the right conditions on one muon. That's the break-even point. And it doesn't work. I think it's died. But it was interesting that we kind of came within a factor 10 of discovering cheap fusion. It wouldn't have been done in a bubble chamber, of course. It would have been done in deuterium, hydrogen and deuterium mixture. This is the second pyramid, which is the one that you were discussing, Rich, which had one chamber in it, but not a very dramatic chamber. It was down at the bottom of the pyramids, and people always speculated that there was a hidden chamber somewhere up higher and more majestic. But I think the sensitivity to muon ranges was such that they got down to where there was no cavity greater than 1 meter on a side or something like that, at which stage they gave up. This picture Rich showed. I want to tell you one other thing that is not in the Chawar book, so I had to steal this abstract from Physics Journal. But it's Louis's careful investigation of the movie camera picture. Remember movie cameras? Of the movie camera picture of the Kennedy assassination. There was a tourist, I guess, by the name of Zapruder. And he had a camera and had the best pictures of the assassination and turned the camera over to the Warren Commission. Is that who investigated?
Well, Warren Commission was at least one. Whether it was turned over to that commission, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, there was actually some crazy combination of Life magazine paid for it and had rights, but Life turned it over to the Warren Commission or something. And the Warren Commission came out. Oh, and somehow or other, Louis was so interested that he had the right contacts, and he managed to get hold of a version of the Zapruder film.
I think it was actually published in Life.
Oh, it was from the still shots.
I believe so. That's my recollection. I know that individual shots were published, whether he got it from that or whether he also got the original.
I'm not sure. But at some stage of the game, he got so interested and so pissed with the FBI that he got hold of the movie. And there are four examples of applying elementary physics that I think are great. At some stage of the game, and I'm not sure that it worked its way all the way into the Warren Report, but at some stage of the game, the FBI decoders, examiners, and so on, declared several things. One, there was a question of whether the movie was running on slow motion, or whether it had two positions, or in real time. And the FBI people said there was no way to tell. So Louis got hold of us one morning and said, all of you guys come outside of Building 50 and just pretend there's some good news and everybody clap. Well, it turns out you can't clap twice as fast. It's just not necessary. There's it's a resonance phenomenon. And if the movie had been on slow motion, then the actual motion would have been twice as fast, and you can't clap twice that fast. But the FBI couldn't figure that out. That was also connected with what was the interval between the shots. As I remember it, and Stan's memory seems to be better than mine, but as I remember, there was a question of, was there really time for Oswald to shoot twice while the car was driving along? And so once the fact that it was not on slow motion took care of that. Then there were people around the lab And there were many people in the United States who had a who believed that there was a conspiracy. And one of the problems was that the film showed that Kennedy's head shot backwards. Oh, the other thing on the shots, this is something that's not in this abstract. The other thing on the shots was, as a precise timing of the shots, Louis and one of his colleagues, I don't remember who, got a camera, not Zapruder's camera, got a camera, made a loud noise close to the camera, and it turns out that if you're running a movie camera and somebody makes a loud noise, you do this. So the film jittered exactly as the time that the shots took place. So they got the timing between the shots correct. The FBI didn't get that either. And then finally, the head snapping back. Well, Louis decided to be an experimentalist, and he and Jerry Lynch went out with some dummy heads, which were cantaloupe wrapped with an appropriate thickness of glass tape, and put these dummy heads on a fence post, a flat surface, and went back a reasonable distance and fired shots at them. And they all fell backwards towards the bullet entry point. And if you stop to think about it, it's a little gory, but the entrance hole for the bullet is pretty small. There's a lot of heat generated. And the exit hole has spread to be something quite big. So you get a jet engine effect, which knocks the head backwards. And it was 6 out of 6 times the cantaloupes rolled back off the bench towards the firing people. Now, that's not what you see in the movies, but it is what you see in real death. So I thought that was pretty clever. And then finally, and I think one of the most interesting points to me was there was a first shot, which is, as I remember, hit the governor of Texas, whose name I can't remember.
Connolly,
yes, right. Now, what's supposed to happen with the Secret Service driving the car is that the driver is supposed to put his foot on the accelerator, accelerate, accelerate and brake so that you're a bad target, and swerve. The trouble is that the man who was driving the car had great seniority and was about 60 years old, and apparently his hearing wasn't very good. So it turns out that what happened is that the car kept on at 12 miles an hour, maybe slowed down 1 mile an hour because there was some confusion, while Oswald had a perfect target for Kennedy and shot him. So that was the real reason that Louis was incensed with the stupidity that was going on. Certainly never wanted to be protected by the FBI. So, I'm going to tell one Louis story, and then I think I'm through. Practical jokes. We were in the middle of an experiment on violation of parity using the 10-inch bubble chamber and looking at something about lambda decays. And Louis was an early invitee to a physics conference in Moscow. And the uncertainty, we thought we found a violation of parity decay, but it turns out that you have to know the number of mirrors there are in the photography circuit for the stereo views in the bubble chamber. And the drawings left some uncertainty. So Louis didn't want to announce violation of parity until he got a telegram from us saying we've actually taken the damn chamber, looked into the chamber and counted the number of reflections, because each reflection was a change of parity. And so with a day or so ahead, we decided, Lynn Stevenson and I and Frank Solmitz and Frank Crawford, I think, decided we would give Louis a bad time. So we sent him a telegram which said, ignore previous telegram. Little did I know, Louis decided it was probably a joke, but he got his retaliation by then calling me at some reasonable Moscow time, but 3 o'clock in the morning on Berkeley time, saying, "What's going on? I need to know." And after getting woken up at 3 a.m. three nights in a row, we decided to send him a telegram which said, "It's okay, you can announce that we've violated parity." Well, that's my little raconteur stuff. And Stan, you're going to run the question period?